Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. This is episode 221. It's 1863. We're in the midst of the Transvaal Civil War. As you heard in episode 220, this was the making of a new president and one who'd take the Trekker Republics into the 20th century, albeit in the midst of the Anglo-Boer War. He had been a rapid and real effect as the farmers took up arms against each other. The Transvaal's economy collapsed. This weakened the government's ability to back up its stated authority. By now, the tiny independent states of Lydenburg and Utrecht had joined the Transvaal, accepting their authority. There had been outliers since the Trekkers first arrived in those regions 15 years earlier. To recap, in 1859, Transvaal President Martinus Wessel Pretorius was invited to stand for president in the Orange Free State. Many burghers there wanted to unify with the Transvaal. They were mainly worried about how to deal with King Moshoeshoe of the Basutu. The Transvaal Constitution that they had just enacted made it illegal to hold office abroad. Still, Pretorius won the latest Transvaal election. Then the Volksraad attempted to sidestep the constitutional problems by granting Pretorius half a year leave. They hoped that a kind of solution would be found in between. Pretorius left for Bloemfontein and appointed Johannes Hermanus Grobler to be acting president in his absence. Pretorius was sworn in as president of the Free State and sent a deputation to Pretoria to negotiate union the next day. Up stepped Stefanus Schoeman from the north of Pretoria, who unsuccessfully attempted to use force to supplant Johannes Grobler as acting president. Schoeman believed that the presidency should have been granted to him, as the new Transvaal Constitution stipulated that in the case of the president's dismissal or death, the presidency should be granted to the oldest member of the Executive Council. Schoeman was 3 years older than Grobler. Schoeman was a fiery character and had been president of the South African Republic / Transvaal from the 6th of December 1860 until 17th April 1862. His red hair added to the picture of hot-headedness, and he was known as Stormvogel den Noorden, Stormbird of the North. He owned two farms, one in the Soutpansberg and the other in Pretoria, where Pretoria's zoo is today. Schoeman was censured for his uprising and relieved of his post. Willem Cornelis Janssen van Rensburg was appointed acting president, while a new election was organized for later in 1862. Paul Krier, who was central in most of these negotiations, returned to his farm Waterkloof outside Rustenburg. Then he received a message urgently requesting his presence in the capital, the Volksraad having recommended him as a suitable candidate. He replied that he was pleased to be summoned, but his membership in the Dopper Church meant that he could not enter politics. Van Rensburg promptly had legislation passed to give equal political rights to members of all reformed denominations. Fast forward to 1863. Krier had defeated Schoeman at a skirmish outside Potchefstroom. He had also managed to convince some of the rebel supporters in the Heidelberg district to switch sides and had ridden back to Pretoria with a local farmer of high standing, Jan Marais. In Pretoria, a council of war determined that rebels like Schoeman were taking advantage of a disagreement between the Transvaal and the Orange Free State. The two fledgling Boer republics could not agree on where the boundary lay between them. Transvaal President Van Rensburg assigned Krier the duty of riding to the Free State to settle the question of the border, and he left almost immediately, taking a group of burghers with him as security. Further west, the Marico district was a hotbed of rebel activity, and the commandant there, Jan Viljoen, heard about Krier's mission and organized a commando. He wanted to ambush Krier and capture the important Transvaal emissary as he approached Potchefstroom on his way south. Viljoen and Schoeman thought they'd use Krier as a hostage for future negotiations. On the way to Potch, a spy warned Krier about what waited. He changed course and set off with a small detachment to confront Viljoen, while Krier's 2IC Feldkornet Sarel Ilof dashed forward to seize a nearby kopje, the all-important high ground. Viljoen, it so happened, was also on his way to the very same kopje. Ilof arrived there first, climbed to the top with his men and looked down on the approaching commando, shouting that they came in peace. This failed to convince Viljoen. His men surrounded Ilof and took them prisoner, then rode back to their camp with their new POWs. Ilof had a quick horse, and after a few minutes of riding passively, he suddenly galloped over the veld, getting away. Viljoen's men couldn't catch him, and they thought better of shooting a fellow Boer in the back. Krio, meanwhile, was out of sight and sound. None of the small band of men with him had seen or heard what was going on. Ilof rushed up to Krio. They both decided to ride on to the Free State despite Viljoen's demands via a messenger that he hand himself over in order to ensure the Transvaal government commander POWs could go home. Viljoen made good on his threats. He began to arrest government supporters around Potchefstroom. While the arresting was going on, Krio and Ilof arrived at Bierman's farm near the Renoster Rivier, just inside the Free State. The Renoster is a tributary of the Vaal River. One of the aspects of this conflict which is interesting is how Krio used his spies, or messengers, as he called them. They were feeding him information daily, information about what Skooman and Viljoen were up to. The capacity to recon an enemy was one of the defining strengths of the Boer military system, and would be sharpened constantly over the coming century and a half. Krio hinted to one of these spies that he never intended to return to the Transvaal, the South African Republic, preferring the Free State because of the interminable squabbling to the north. He went further. Krio bought a Free State farm and sent for a team of oxen to bring his family to the Free State. The spy, who was now an unwary messenger, returned to the rebels and repeated what Krio had said. The secret about Krio's Free State farm was that he hadn't actually paid for it. He had a gentleman's agreement with the owner that as soon as the war was settled, he'd give it back. The ruse appeared to work, because Viljoen set government commander prisoners free. But what Krio appeared to be unaware of himself was that there was more than one set of spies on the landscape. Skooman had his own private intelligence gathering operation. While they missed the Free State farm trick, they were aware of every move the government commander was making. And right now, a large commando was hunkered down north of Pretoria between the Crocodile River and Pienaar Rivier. The Crocodile River has since been dammed at the famous Magaliesberg mountain notch, where the peaks are broken in two by the force of the river over millions of years. The Hartbeespoort Dam's catchment area encompasses the Crocodile River and its tributaries, as well as the Magalies River, and the dam wall uses the strong quartzite ridges of the Magaliesberg formation for its base and anchoring. Back to 1863. The rebels gathered north of Pretoria, planning to attack the government commander. Krio was informed about Skooman's intentions and rushed back from the Free State. He began what would be an epic ride, taking 2 days to reach Waterkloof, his farm outside Rustenburg. Veldkornet Ilof left Krio there and headed northwest towards Swart Ruggens to commandeer more burghers. It was a Sunday, so Krio, the ever-devout Dopper, rested until nightfall, then rode on to Swartkoppies, where President van Rensburg was resting with his men alongside Pienaar Rivier. That's south of the modern town of Brits. It appeared Krio arrived just in time. Monday, the next day, the rebel commander hove into view. Both sides now rushed to reach the top of Swartkoppies, knowing that once again holding the high ground was essential. The rebels and government burghers reached the summit simultaneously and began to fire on each other. A government Boer called Enslin was shot dead. About half a dozen were wounded on either side in the half-hour engagement, which was broken off by the rebels, who then fled south in the direction of Pretoria. Krio told his men to cease fire, pointing out they were not really shooting at enemies, but brothers. Ilof arrived at that moment, and he was in a different frame of mind. Having managed to scrape together a large posse of 50 men, he wanted to chase the rebels and shoot them down. It took a great deal of persuasion from Krio before Ilof relented. A surreal calm descended. The rebels crept back towards Swartkoppies and secured their wagons, dragging them into a lager a few kilometres from the government lager. Ilof was dispatched to keep them under surveillance. The rebels appeared to be in no mood to give up the fight. They could be seen setting up their cannon that night. Ilof also spotted ex-Transvaal President Pretorius enter the rebel lager. The next day, Pretorius sent a message to Krio to join him for a peace conference. Krio headed up the government delegation, along with Johannes Grobler, the ousted acting president, who upset fiery-haired Skooman. Ex-President Pretorius led the rebels' negotiating team. The Volksraad, however, would have to ratify any agreement. Krio opened the meeting by saying that his recon unit had kept the rebels under close scrutiny all night, seemingly unaware that they were doing the very same to him. The talks paid off, an agreement was penned that a new presidential election should be held and any new government had to be recognised by the Volksraad. Quite a simple solution, you'd say. The problem for both sides was summed up in a word: justice. What form would it take? Schoeman believed he was the victim of injustice. The government believed Schoeman had unjustly started a civil war. That was a bit of a sticking point. What kind of court of arbitration could be set up to judge those accused of crimes during a civil war? And what were these crimes? One man's rebel is another man's freedom fighter, you know. Both parties said the judges would have to come from the Free State. Folks, there are remarkable resonances in this apparently distant little civil war. When the Union of South Africa was achieved in 1910, Bloemfontein was nominated as the seat of the Supreme Court of the Union. Cape Town and Pretoria shared power, Parliament in Cape Town, Pretoria the seat of government. Free State is slap bang in the middle, so they got the Supreme Court. But you can trace this logic all the way back to the Transvaal Civil War of 1862 to 1864. This seemingly distant and for some irrelevant conflict revealed a need for something negotiable, and the territory itself became identifiable as the centre. It was 1864, and as Krier and Pretoria sat talking alongside the Crocodile River, they naturally turned to the Free Staters as referees. The rebels also wanted a commission to be set up to police the agreement. They really did not trust the government, and this commission must have free and immediate access to President van Rensburg's office. Krier and his delegates consented, and former President Pretorius was chosen to chair the commission, a decision steeped in symmetry, for South Africa's story is one told in the language of inquiries and panels, commissions upon commissions, as if justice here requires endless rehearsal. We are fated to return again and again to the architecture of deliberation. Krier and a rebel by the name of Fourie, along with young Krap as secretary, were dispatched to the Orange Free State to ask for judges to help. The rebel and government burghers dispersed and went back to their farms. Krier rode to the Free State, where he was met by the fourth and new president, Johannes Henricus Brandt. Instead of suggesting a few judges they could hire for the upcoming hearings, Brandt advised the Transvaal delegation to settle their differences amicably rather than in court. And here is another example of a uniquely South African form of justice. He warned the visiting Transvaalers that if they left justice to an impartial court, too many burghers would end up sentenced. That justice in this case may only deepen the wounds. Far better, he argued, to reach an understanding between the sides. He even flat out refused to appoint judges to try his own people. So Krier went looking for a precedent, something to guide the Boers through this legal and moral thicket, and he eventually found it. As he wrote in his memoirs, an old jurist once argued that, in the aftermath of civil war, rebellion charges could be swept aside through general amnesty, so long as those most responsible stepped down from their posts. That, it seemed, was the way forward to finally end the Transvaal Civil War. This is another example of where historical America and South Africa intersect. The American Civil War was in full swing by 1863, and Abraham Lincoln had suggested something quite similar to end it. The principle that rebellion charges could be dismissed through general amnesty, provided key figures relinquished their positions, has historical precedence predating 1864. President George Washington's response to the 1794 Whiskey Rebellion is another example. After that uprising was quelled, Washington issued a general pardon to participants, emphasizing moderation and national unity over punitive measures. As Washington said at the time, the government must assert its authority, but it should also exercise every degree of moderation and tenderness which justice, dignity, and safety may permit. This approach influenced subsequent leaders, including President Abraham Lincoln, who issued the Proclamation of Amnesty and Reconstruction, offering a full pardon to those who participated in the American Civil War, excluding high-ranking Confederate officials and military leaders. The policy aimed to facilitate national reconciliation by restoring rights to former Confederates who pledged loyalty to the Union. This is something that modern American political leaders appear to have forgotten in their bitter, self-devouring blood feud. These historical instances reflect a legal and political philosophy that, in the aftermath of internal conflict, prioritizing national healing through amnesty can be more beneficial than widespread punitive actions. However, it also presumes that principal instigators are removed from power. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which sat at the end of apartheid, was motivated by the same sentiment. Provide some closure for victims by publicly announcing your crimes. Hold elections, which would remove the National Party from power. So in 1864, Krier and Pretorius returned to Pretoria and heeded President Brandt's advice. The Transvaal Volksraad accepted the proposal, and with that, peace was officially restored. They also agreed to hold a new presidential election, a chance to reset the political order. And then, at Krier's request, another vote was called, this time to choose the Commandant General. He wanted to make sure that the Volk hadn't lost confidence in him. When the results came in, Krier secured more than two-thirds of the vote. The Volk had spoken. What was less clear was what the rest of the people around the Boers thought about all of these goings-ons. It was an opportunity for some to seize back the land they'd lost and the political power they'd forsaken. In the far north, the initial friendly relations with the Bapedi people had not lost. To the east, the AmaZulu realized the Boers were weakened by the civil war and trouble was brewing there. To the south, King Mashweshwe also spotted the opportunity. So too did the Baralong to the west. Next episode, we'll take a broad look at what was going on across South Africa in 1863 to 1865. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platform. It helps elevate visibility. And you can head off to desmondlatham.blog, where I'm going to load an update about various episodes. You can also email me from there. Until next, tot ziens.